Rex would explain it to a group of curious college students early in 2016. The first time I went over to see Putin, Sechin, and the others after the sanctions were in place, I was a little nervous, he said. And it was interesting because the first question they asked me was, well, how are you doing? Are you okay? And I said, well, yeah, I'm fine. Why do you ask? They said, well, we just wondered whether your government was coming after you because you've been doing business with us. They were more worried about me. And so they understood. Chapter 24. Yeah, that was crazy. Austin Holland's dream job at the Oklahoma Geological Survey was turning out to be not all that dreamy. In fact, being the head seismologist for Oklahoma had become a kind of nightmare. An 80 to 90 hour a week, never see your children, everybody is screaming at you, nightmare. Holland had plenty of sympathy among the scientific community, both inside and outside his adopted state. You've got a tough job, guy, one former employee of the OGS wrote, but only at the end of a long email suggesting how Austin Holland might better do that job. A colleague of Holland's wrote to friends in early 2014, if Austin hasn't aged 20 years in the past three, he's a better man than I. We have a new geophysicist to help Austin out, but it's not the science, it's the politics, and she, no one, will be able to help him out on that account. By the fall of 2014, though, people in the field, even the people rooting for him, were finding it hard to forgive or even explain Austin Holland's continuing reticence about the probable causes of the new, fairly terrifying earthquake swarms in Oklahoma. Historically unshaky Oklahoma had suddenly become the earthquake capital of America. The year 2014 was shaping up like no other in recorded state history. Landlocked, stable little Oklahoma had suffered triple the number of earthquakes that runner-up California had. Not okay. The only other categories where Oklahoma led the country were top-tier college football, annual decreases in public school funding per student, and the rate of female incarceration. But on seismic activity, the state's prowess really stood out. There were 16 magnitude 4.0 quakes in Oklahoma in the first 6 months of 2014 alone. There were 268 magnitude 3.0 or better. That's in a state that had averaged fewer than two 3.0 plus quakes annually for the 60 years before 2008. The cause seemed pretty clear to anybody paying attention. The increase in seismicity was concurrent with the increase in newfangled, unconventional oil and gas drilling in the state. And yes, correlation isn't causation, but it felt as though every dentist and barber and dry cleaner in the state was certain that the problem was fracking. The layman's diagnosis was partially true, but seismologists and petroleum geologists and hydrologists were beginning to reach a more nuanced understanding. Hydraulic fracturing itself, breaking oil and gas out of shale rock, might cause an earthquake in one in every 10 or even one in every 20 fracked wells. But the bigger culprit appeared to be the way the drillers were disposing of the billions of gallons of used slick water and produced water the earth vomited up once the drillers were done with the fracturing part. And then, too, there was another fracking-era unconventional production process at play, something called dewatering, wherein Oklahoma drillers would vacuum up more millions of gallons of ancient briny underground fluid, separate out the oil and gas, and then re-inject the extracted fluid back into the depths of the earth. All this appeared to be playing havoc with the pressures and stresses on long, quiet faults down in the basement rock, just beneath what the business calls the economically interesting strata, which means where the oil and gas is. Academic papers had started to draw links between the earthquakes and the extraction and injection of increasing quantities of this underground goo. But there were so many unanswered questions about how much was too much. At what volume did you risk triggering quakes? Were there rates and depths of injection that were less dangerous than others? Could you fiddle with the timing to make the process safer? Austin Holland had remained cautious as well, perhaps to a fault. He knew he was privy to a field of data that could really upset people, especially all the folks in Oklahoma who made their money in the oil and gas industry. He'd been yelled at plenty by 2014. But Austin Holland also knew the data could provide real insight into this awe-inspiring new human capacity to alter the environment. The scientific term at issue would be induced seismicity, man-made earthquakes. Imagine that. It's one thing to know we can visit Mars and invent the internet, but seriously, human beings can make big earthquakes? Thousands of them? The meek may inherit the earth, but the bold could certainly screw it up in the interim. From the time Austin Holland arrived in Oklahoma in 2010, through the first seismic swarms, and the record-breaking earthquake in Prague in 2011, and the exponential growth of felt quakes in his state, he remained determined to study induced seismicity the right way, using all the new raw data to make a real contribution to the scientific literature. But there was so much to keep up with now, 10 or 12 magnitude 3.0 earthquakes every week. Each event produced useful new data points, which would help him be both accurate and confident in his conclusions. Holland meant those conclusions to be unassailable, so he tried as best he could to keep his head down and do his work to do good science. He was also determined to produce a crucial tool the state lacked, a comprehensive and exquisitely detailed map of the faults that existed in the geologic strata that underlay the state. If Oklahoma was going to start shaking at this point in the 21st century, it was worth knowing where the shaking would most likely commence. But that kind of project would take time, too. And he had so little time, he never seemed to have enough time. All of this meant Holland did not feel comfortable enough, even in 2014, to make a definitive statement to the public at large about the precise perils of the oil and gas industry practice of wastewater injection. He had started to suggest the real possibility of oil and gas operations contributing to specific seismic events as early as 2011, but chiefly in peer-reviewed papers. He took pains not to incite undue public alarm or to point toward any conclusions he couldn't prove from fact. We clearly need to examine the issues and are actively working to understand them, but none of the discussion that is occurring within the popular media is at all helpful to the discussion or the science, Holland wrote to a fellow seismologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. Every hour I spend talking to reporters is another 2 hours I really can't be doing the research that needs to be done. Holland was more open with his brethren at scientific conferences, but even there, he seemed to hold back. Rivka Galchin from The New Yorker caught this interaction at an induced seismicity conference outside Oklahoma City in November 2014. Someone asked Holland about several earthquakes of greater than 4.0 magnitude, which had occurred a few days earlier across Oklahoma's northern border in Kansas. Galchin wrote in a piece subtitled, "The Arrival of Man-Made Earthquakes." Holland joked, "Well, the earthquakes aren't stopping at the state line, but my problems do." There was a follow-up question. Why had there previously been no quakes in Kansas, and now for a year and a half there have been so many? As the question was asked, a couple of men wandered into the back of the room, where trays of beer and soda were set up. Holland called out, "Well, Justin, what do you think of that question?" The U.S. Geological Survey's Justin Rubenstein, one of the three organizers of the conference, said, "Well, if you map the fluid injection records and the earthquake records, there you go." Holland said, "Well, you heard it from him, not me." Occasionally that fall, evidence of Holland's vexation seeped out, like when a petroleum geologist who was certain that many of these earthquakes were unquestionably productions of the oil and gas industry buttonholed Holland after his presentation at the Osage Nation's annual oil and gas summit in Tulsa. During Holland's question and answer session and afterwards in the lobby, we had several exchanges. "I pressed him hard," Bob Jackman wrote in the Oklahoma Observer. Frustrated, he blurted out, "You don't understand. Harold Hamm and others will not allow me to say certain things." Holland later claimed Jackman misquoted him. Jackman was sure of the quotation and said he wrote it down at the time. "Harold Hamm and others will not allow me to say certain things." Subsequent reporting certainly bolsters the fact of that matter, if not the actual quotation. The way Harold Hamm saw it, Folks just didn't understand what a dire threat all this earthquake talk posed. They didn't seem to appreciate what a ferocious multi-front battle he was engaged in, and how vigilant he had to be in controlling the narrative. It wasn't just the seismology crowd, the earthquake geeks. It was the politicians and the do-gooders. The entire Obama administration, he sometimes complained, was hostile to oil and gas. The response by this administration has been to put the foot on your neck, Ham would say to his nodding cheerleaders on the business channels. There were people out there who wanted to tear him down, to tear down the idea at the heart of his America, to obstruct American progress. Continued threats against business is not what makes your economy grow, he said. Ham, the founder and chairman of Continental Resources, was working like heck to protect all that was great and good in the U.S. of A., which meant he had to keep telling his own story. And inspiring as it was, he felt the burden to keep improving on it. That wasn't easy or cheap. Ham and his wife, Sue Ann, had donated $20 million to the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center, the biggest gift in the history of the institution, several million dollars more than they had just paid for a lovely 6,400-acre cattle ranch in Carmel, California. That gift to the university would fight a disease that menaced more than 600,000 people in his home state. The Harold Ham Oklahoma Diabetes Center is on a mission to find a cure, OU's president David Boren said in announcing the donation in 2011. While we work toward that goal, we are educating people about the challenges of living with diabetes, teaching them how to prevent the development of diabetes and its complications, and providing the best possible diabetes care. Ham and his medical researchers might not ever beat the disease. He understood that. But write a check that size, and not only do you generate a whole lot of goodwill, but you control the story. Oklahomans should never forget Harold Ham had their best interests at heart. Other menaces to the well-being of his fellow Oklahomans didn't give themselves over to simple check-writing solutions. These stories were much more difficult to control, stories where other people might have something to say in opposition. That's why it had required real time and effort and money to get Oklahoma's unpopular horizontal drilling oil and gas tax break extended into eternity. But Ham had made it happen. That law was on the books by the fall of 2014. And now the whole man-made earthquake problem, the whole oil and gas-made earthquake problem, threatened to tar the entire industry. This storyline was shaping up as complicated and insidious. And Ham had seen it coming. This unsubstantiated, by his lights, charge had been a thorn in his side for at least 3 years. The issue first caught his interest when that damned scientist, Austin Holland, published a scientific paper in 2011, less than 6 months after Ham's $20 million diabetes donation. The paper suggested that a series of mini quakes around Elmore City might not be the normal, naturally occurring event everyone suspected. The state's new and clearly more energetic seismologist had made a study of the data and found there was likely a correlation between the swarm of seismicity near Elmore City and the onset of fracking at a nearby well. Our analysis showed that shortly after hydraulic fracturing began, small earthquakes started occurring, and more than 50 were identified, of which 43 were large enough to be located. Holland's boss, Larry Grillot, who was dean of the University of Oklahoma's Mewbourne College of Earth and Energy, had forwarded Holland's findings to the big Oklahoma City oil companies and the head of the Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association as soon as he saw it. Grillot had been a longtime executive at Phillips Petroleum, and he figured the major frackers would want a heads up. Oil companies like to get ahead of any potential public relations problem. The president of the OIPA immediately told Grillot it might be a good idea for the two of them to sit down with this Austin Holland and, you know, explain things. Oh, and by the way, he told Grillot, one of his board members, Harold Ham, was already setting a meeting with OU's president, David Boren, who also just happened to sit on the board of Ham's company, Continental Resources. I guess I'll just wait for my marching orders, Dean Grillot responded. And it looks like this is starting to fall into the category of no good deed goes unpunished. Harold Ham, it turns out, did have marching orders to issue. which went down the chain of command from the university president, David Boren, to the dean, Larry Grillot, to Austin Holland's direct boss, Randy Keller, head of the Oklahoma Geological Survey. As all of that rolled downhill onto him, Holland was encouraged, among other things, to revise his most recent public-facing PowerPoint presentation. His slide on earthquakes was scrubbed of any mention of disposal, recovery, or fracturing, anything that could be traced back to oil and gas. His conclusion that there was scientific evidence of a correlation between hydraulic fracturing and seismic events in Elmore City was diplomatically elided. Holland really wasn't looking to pick a fight. He told his bosses he thought the edits from on high might help the Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association feel better about the presentation. So Ham's intercession to keep the science at bay worked for a while. The man-made earthquake question in Oklahoma remained a non-issue for the next few years, which makes this a case study in what happens when a powerful industry thoroughly captures a state government. In theory, an industry's job is to make money, to serve its customers, and provide for its employees and shareholders, while the government's job is to make sure the industry operates on a level playing field, that companies follow the law and don't endanger others. When government is no match for the power of the industry, though, it instead becomes an enabler, an apologist, and often a corrupt participant in the industry running roughshod. There's a reason why the oil derricks were built first and the state capitol dome was tacked on a while later in Oklahoma. And so even upon the arrival of the most powerful earthquake in Oklahoma history, that huge 5.7 magnitude quake that hit the little town of Prague, the reputation of oil and gas was protected from any damaging political aftershocks. As Governor Mary Fallon's communications team considered the wisdom of the governor engaging questions on the quakes at an upcoming conference co-sponsored by the Oklahoma Secretary of Energy, her communications director wrote to the public relations squad, "Probably actually not a great topic. She could certainly say, yeah, that was crazy. The problem is, some people are trying to blame hydraulic fracturing, a necessary process for extracting natural gas, for causing earthquakes. This is an energy conference, heralding natural gas as the energy source of the future. So you see the awkward position that puts us in. I would rather not have that debate." But the beauty of being in the Mary Fallon administration was that an awkward position like that was very easy to resolve. It took only one quick phone call to get everyone on the same page and to get a set of talking points to the governor in case she found herself in the emergency situation of being cornered by a curious and, God forbid, well-informed reporter. The helpful talking points missive came from one of the state's most active frackers, Devon Energy. "There is no current evidence that oil and gas operations had anything to do with the recent large earthquakes," read Devon's memo for the governor. "Such events are not uncommon in Oklahoma. According to the Oklahoma Geological Survey, the earthquake characteristics of both intensity and depth essentially rule out man-made causes." All of which turned out to be somewhere between premature, misleading, and outright bullpucky. But what was she going to do? Tell Devon Energy to stuff it? Unimaginable. At least for that state at that time. It should be noted, though, that Oklahoma's strategy wasn't the only way to approach this unusual new problem. Around the same time, the state of Ohio had also seen an uptick in earthquakes believed to be induced by industry. Rather than calling up the oil companies to give the governor talking points to deny it was happening, Ohio sent a very clear message to the fracking and dewatering pros by shutting down a disposal well near an active fault. "We won't hesitate to stop operation of disposal sites if we have concerns," said the director of Ohio's Department of Natural Resources. "And while our research doesn't point to a clear and direct correlation to drilling at this site and seismic activity, we will never gamble when safety is a factor." Oklahoma's state government, unsurprisingly, was more willing to roll the dice. Which meant Austin Holland and the Oklahoma Geological Survey were the flies in the petroleum-based ointment. Holland again irked the industry by going to a conference in Florida in January 2013 and pointing at large-volume injection wells as a possible trigger for the big Prague earthquake. One of Holland's colleagues at OU, the geophysicist Katie Karinen, was even more direct. There's a compelling link between the zone of injection and the seismicity, she had been saying. And in March 2013, she backed up that statement with detailed evidence in a peer-reviewed paper using the readings from the Prague aftershocks to literally find fault. If the geologists are right, noted Columbia University's Earth Institute, it would mean that fault lines are far more sensitive to human activity than previously thought. Oklahoma's government was positively wired to do whatever the oil and gas industry wanted, no matter the cost, no matter the damage. And now, here were these perky young scientists employed by state institutions telling not just Oklahomans, but the whole country that oil and gas were the bad guys here? And showing their work to prove it? No, not okay. Not okay at all. Holland was forced to mouth an official Oklahoma Geological Survey rebuttal of his colleague Karinen's paper as soon as it became public. He wrote up a detailed report for his bosses on just where the research stood, and then saw it boiled down to a single page, which included statements best understood as either misdirection, like this one. Some researchers have observed that the earthquake activity did not increase over time as injection increased, but rather occurred in a distinct swarm more typical of a natural event. Some of the statements were also just total hooey, like this one. The interpretation that best fits current data is that the Prague earthquake sequence was the result of natural causes. Yeah, as if. Austin Holland would not soon forget subsequent meetings at the offices of New Dominion, owner and operator of the injection wells in question near the Prague site. New Dominion's VP of exploration, Gene Antonides, and his crew were on the attack against Karinen for having the gall to publish a peer-reviewed paper based on all the data that had been gleaned from Prague. We were told that they were looking at ways to file a lawsuit against her, Holland said in his 2017 deposition for a civil suit filed against New Dominion. They just wanted to make things uncomfortable for her, is what they said. Dr. Karinen found herself another job about 1,500 miles away at Cornell University. She was out of Oklahoma in a few months. Austin Holland decided to soldier on at OGS because, despite the sound and fury from the industry, he believed the survey itself and its minders at Oklahoma University were committed to doing good science. And for all the Harold Hams and the New Dominions and their thuggish tactics, there were also a number of oil companies in the state that were happy to share data and were willing to exchange ideas in preparation for issuing an updated set of best practices for safe drilling and wastewater injection. The Oklahoma Corporation Commission, the state agency that regulated the oil and gas industry, was actually moving toward stricter rules for permitting. Holland kept telling himself he was making things better. He kept telling himself the fights were all about public relations and nothing to do with the actual science. We have the academic freedoms necessary for university employees doing research, he insisted. But he must have been slightly chagrined when Antonides from New Dominion insisted that Austin Holland should chase down his asinine pet theory that the earthquakes were caused by the long drought, followed by periods of torrential rains, which filled up the underground aquifers too rapidly. It was bad enough that Antonides was out there flogging his stupid theory about how the heavy rains did it. Were long droughts and heavy rains a new variable in Oklahoma? But he was also disparaging anybody who linked the New Dominion injection wells with the Prague quake. That's people watching too many Superman movies, Antonides told one reporter. Some individuals pick only the data that serves their purpose. Antonides also tried a sort of backflip, handspring, triple twist salesmanship trick when he made the case that the Oklahoma quakes were a good thing. See, states that didn't have them are the ones who should worry. To sell this particular idea, he called on a false theory that smaller earthquakes diminish the stress on faults and thus avert bigger quakes. What happens if there had not been that release of energy, he said. They're kind of a savior. They help keep down the big ones. Sure, that's a good one. It's one thing to just threaten and deride people and throw your weight around. But in a scientific battle, The scientists were going to have an advantage over the guys talking about quake saviors and Superman and the rain. By the fall of 2013, the OGS and the U.S. Geological Survey decided it was time to issue a joint statement on what was going on in Oklahoma. The statement, which Holland helped prepare, was hardly a barn burner. It simply announced that the two agencies were conducting collaborative research, quantifying the changes in earthquake rate in the Oklahoma City region, assessing the implications of this swarm for large earthquake hazard, and evaluating possible links between these earthquakes and wastewater disposal related to oil and gas production activities in the region. The USGS's lead seismologist said the jump in earthquake rates does not seem to be due to typical random fluctuations in natural seismicity rates. The analysis suggests that a contributing factor to the increase in earthquake triggers may be from activities such as wastewater disposal, a phenomenon known as injection-induced seismicity. Tepid as the public pronouncement was, Harold Hamm took it hard. He decided he needed to get serious and start shutting this thing down. He dispatched his senior vice president for exploration, Jack Stark, to meet personally with Austin Holland at the offices of the Oklahoma Corporation Commission. Commissioner Patrice Douglas insisted to Holland at that meeting that she wanted to be able to make data-driven decisions that protected the safety of Oklahomans while also protecting the demonstrable economic rewards of the state's shale industry. Stark just wanted the whole thing kept quiet. They're in denial phase that induced seismicity is a possibility, Holland reported to Dean Grillot and Director Keller after the meeting. Holland later explained that it was clear that Continental did not want any discussions of induced seismicity in any shape or form. For his part, Stark was apparently not satisfied with the outcome of that sit-down with Austin Holland. The public information coordinator at the Oklahoma Geological Survey got what felt to her like a very aggressive call on a Monday afternoon from a woman who said she was affiliated with Continental Resources. It was not clear exactly how she was affiliated because the woman started barking questions right from the start of the conversation. She wanted to know if the OGS was connected with the U.S. Geological Survey and if OGS employees worked for the state. She really kept asking about who pays us, the information officer, Connie G. Smith, reported in an email to Holland, Keller, and Grillot. She kept asking who we work for, and I kept saying, we're a state agency. We're part of the Mewbourne College of Earth and Energy at Oklahoma University. And then she said, do you work for Oklahoma University? And I said, we are paid and under the administration of the University of Oklahoma. She sounded like a lawyer because she was very brusque and was really grilling me and asking the same things over and over, and I immediately wanted to put my hand on a Bible, or on OGS Bulletin 40 at least. Holland emailed a reply to the rattled Smith an hour and a half later with news that he had received his own grab-the-Bible call that same day. He'd been invited to coffee with OU President David Boren and Harold Hamm. It would be a command performance at the president's office, just the three of them. Smith wrote back, gosh, I guess that's better than having Kool-Aid with them, I guess. The meeting with President Boren, who was soon to get his own statue on campus, and Harold Hamm, the richest man in Oklahoma, was, as Holland would later deadpan, just a little bit intimidating. Boren assured Holland at the top of the meeting that he had complete academic freedom, which right away was a pretty strong indication that he did not. But he told him that being a part of the OGS meant he had to listen to people within the oil and gas industry, too. So Holland listened, while Harold Hamm filibustered. Harold Hamm presented himself as a man under siege, standing up for an industry under siege, and unfairly so. He expressed to me that I had to be careful of the way in which I say things, that hydraulic fracturing is critical to the state's economy in Oklahoma, and that me publicly stating that earthquakes can be caused by hydraulic fracturing was, you know, could be misleading, and that he was nervous about the war on fossil fuels at the time. That's a phrase that stuck with Holland, the war on fossil fuels, as if it were a war on America itself. Harold Hamm even talked about the bad rap that coal was getting. But he circled back to fracking and how maybe Holland had allowed a study on one well in Elmore City to bring him to the wrong conclusion. Holland sat quiet, even though the data and the science were clearly on his side. He didn't call Ham's attention to the raft of recent peer-reviewed scientific literature about the connections between increased seismicity and hydraulic fracturing, and, more important, between increased seismicity and wastewater disposal. He didn't call attention to the fact that his own recent paper on the topic had also been peer-reviewed. Holland had been around long enough to understand the futility of arguing with a successful Oklahoma oil man, especially the most successful Oklahoma oil man. Honestly, it was nothing different than what I'd heard from those in the oil and gas industry since I basically showed up in Oklahoma, so it wasn't anything new. And I've been yelled at before. At least I wasn't getting yelled at. Holland didn't feel much better after that meeting, but he hadn't gone in expecting to. Funny thing was, neither did Harold Ham, who clearly didn't feel that Austin Holland had entirely taken to heart his concerns. He had doubts about this young scientist's willingness to thunder up for the oil and gas team. Ham wanted all public comments out of OGS to henceforth come from the office of the university's longtime and trusted spokeswoman. And he was under the impression that David Boren had made that happen. "I am glad you put Catherine Bishop in charge," Ham wrote to Boren a few weeks after that delightful coffee meeting with Austin Holland. "This situation could spiral out of hand easily." What did spiral out of hand soon after was the sheer number of earthquakes in Oklahoma. When the pace of quakes nearly tripled in 2014 from the year before, the USGS and the OGS put out another joint statement, updating their earlier one. "The likelihood of future damaging earthquakes in central and north central Oklahoma has increased as a result of the increased number of small and moderate shocks." So much for the idea that the little shakers kept the big ones at bay. "Building owners and government officials should have a special concern for older, unreinforced brick structures, which are vulnerable to serious damage during sufficient shaking," said Holland's counterpart at the USGS. National Geographic picked up the story of the growing problem and its by now clear association with unconventional drilling. "Underground disposal of wastewater from fracking may pose a much greater risk of causing dangerous earthquakes than previously believed," was their lead. Worse yet, scientists are not yet able to predict which wastewater injection sites are likely to pose risks to buildings or critical structures, such as power plants, and do not yet know what operators might do to mitigate the hazard. So consider Harold Ham at that moment, whose net worth had climbed up around $20 billion by the summer of 2014, with more and better wells coming online all the time. His newest well in the Bakken was producing a record number of barrels per day. He had just won his signature victory in the Oklahoma State Legislature, horizontal drilling tax breaks forever. But he still felt like Ayn Rand's John Galt, with all those envious, small-minded bureaucrat number crunchers picking at him. Those parochial obstructionists putting limits on American businesses' God-given freedoms. How many lesser oil and gas and coal producers would be casualties of this war on fossil fuels? Well, he could play rough if he had to, and he would. Austin Holland got Ham's rough treatment at a remove. When Austin or his new colleague, Amberlee Darrold, popped up in public with a statement or a paper, they were usually whack-a-moled back into their quiet hole by their bosses at OU and OGS. Holland felt as if Dean Grillot and Director Keller were looking over his shoulder more than ever. "They helped me with presentations. They'd take a look and change for the public, change wording and that sort of thing," he explained in his 2017 deposition. "They would tell me that they had gotten a bunch of calls, complaints, after I'd given a news conference about some earthquake or something. And they'd say they had gotten a lot of complaints and that we need to really watch how we say things. I also had points where the dean of the college asked to see my presentations to scientific meetings and would then wordsmith my presentations. At one point, I was asked to withdraw an abstract from a scientific meeting in Arkansas because the topic was earthquakes triggered by hydraulic fracture." What Holland maybe didn't fully appreciate was the exact nature of the pressure that Grillot and Keller and Boren were getting and then passing on down to him. Harold Hamm had not just written a $20 million check to the University of Oklahoma. Hell, he was paying David Boren around $350,000 in cash and stock that year alone to sit on the board of Continental Resources, which was about as much as Boren made as a full-time university president. When Harold Hamm spoke, everybody in the administration at OU felt more than obliged to hear him out. Like when Hamm called Grillot to a meeting at Continental Resources headquarters in downtown Oklahoma City on an unseasonably cool day in July 2014. Maybe Hamm was irked about what Amberly Darrell told a reporter from Time magazine for a story on the booming earthquake insurance industry in Oklahoma. "It's known," she said, "that fracking can cause earthquakes and has caused earthquakes." That was her quotation in print in a national magazine. "There's no question with fracking," she said. Or maybe he was upset about Holland and Darrell's recent public presentation under the OU banner, which included these ditties. "Most seismologists believe the drastic rate change is not due to natural seismicity. We do see earthquakes likely triggered by hydraulic fracturing. We do see some potential cases of induced seismicity from disposal wells. Scientists generally agree that this triggered seismicity poses the greater risk, larger magnitudes." Whatever it was, Harold Hamm was clearly itching to be heard that July day. When Grillot was waiting to be escorted up to Hamm's office, he saw President Boren on his way out. Grillot later made note in an email that Hamm would shortly be talking with Governor Fallon about putting the Oklahoma Geological Survey under more reliable, industry-friendly overseers than just the academics at the University of Oklahoma. But when Grillot made his report of the meeting to OU's Vice President for External Relations and Planning, the top line item was much more sharply pointed. "Mr. Hamm is very upset at some of the earthquake reporting," Grillot wrote in an email a few hours after the meeting broke up, "to the point that he would like to see select OGS staff dismissed." The university administration had the good sense to not immediately start axing employees explicitly because they refused to toe the oil and gas party line. But Harold Hamm still appeared to be in control of the bigger story. He dispatched his company's vice president for geology, Glenn Brown, to mitigate the damage being caused by these reckless scientist loudmouths. "The natural swarm of earthquakes," Brown explained, "is of very small magnitude and very small impact. Quite frankly, the way that people are talking about it is over-exaggerating what's going on." Glenn Brown was also running around Oklahoma City saying the swarms could very well have a global cause. That is, according to one reporter who heard his pitch, "major tectonic shifts in the Earth's crust triggered by earthquakes in Japan and Haiti." Okay, sure, Japan did it. And Haiti, definitely nothing closer to home. And Continental Resources didn't exactly have to roll the boulder up the mountain when it came to selling its self-exculpatory story in the state. When the Democratic candidate running against Mary Fallon for governor in 2014 suggested that the new science on induced seismicity was compelling and that state officials should be obligated to make sure industries are applying safe practices, the editorial page of the state's largest paper, The Oklahoman, shot him down. "Most unacceptable is the notion that the science has been done. In fact, the research is only beginning." The Republican state rep from the earthquake-swarmed area around the town of Jones, Oklahoma, told Newsweek that the science was sure to find frackers and wastewater disposers innocent of any and all seismicity-inducing malfeasance. He was quite philosophical about it all. "The earth and the science of how everything works is so big. We are so minute," said Representative Lewis Moore. "For us to think that we have so much to do with these things is almost ludicrous." Chapter 25, Active Appreciation. There were signs in the fall of 2014 that Harold Hamm might be losing his grip on his own story. an eagle-eyed set of reporters from Reuters caught on to an odd series of edits in Continental Resources' official literature. Deleted from the timeline on Continental's website was an entry about Harold Hamm's critical personal role in striking oil in Oklahoma in 1974. Also gone was any mention of Continental's game-changing decision to make a big move into the Rocky Mountain region in 1993. The website now ceded partial credit to another company for a key discovery in the Bakken and scrubbed its brag about Continental being the first to complete a long horizontal multifrac in North Dakota. Even more jarring was a deletion in Hamm's personal bio in Continental Resources' latest proxy statement. As founder of the company, Mr. Hamm is one of the driving forces behind the company and its success to date. Over the course of the company's history, Mr. Hamm has successfully grown the company through his leadership skills and business judgment. All that crowing was there in 2013, but it was all gone in 2014. The exercise in revision seemed like a planned campaign to minimize the previously mythic eminence of Harold Hamm, which is exactly what it was. And it was all because, turns out, Harold didn't have a prenup. The revisionist history about Harold Hamm's role in building Continental Resources was part of a carefully executed legal strategy that was designed to keep his soon-to-be ex-wife from dipping too deeply into his trove of assets. The Reuters team made the discovery near the end of the 9-week trial of Hamm versus Hamm, which was taking place at the county courthouse in Oklahoma City. The journalists had plenty of free time to do enterprise reporting because the judge in the case had decided to close almost all of the divorce proceedings to the press and the public. Much of the evidence at trial involved proprietary information about the company's finances and operations. There's no sense destroying a company over a divorce trial, the judge explained. And so a sign was affixed to the door of Courtroom 121, "Do not enter." This was disappointing to rubberneckers. Speculation outside the courthouse had been pretty frothy even before the trial commenced, and not on account of the emotional matrimonial mishigas. She said he was unfaithful. He said the marriage was loveless for years. Ho-hum. It wasn't human drama driving interest in Hamm versus Hamm. It was epic financial drama. The numbers involved were just enormous. The Hamms' combined net worth at the beginning of the trial in August 2014, with Continental stock prices at all-time highs and the price of West Texas crude still up around $100 a barrel, their combined net worth was estimated to be $20 billion. If Sue Ann Hamm's attorneys managed to peel off a quarter of that for their client, that would be the biggest divorce settlement on record anywhere, anytime. Other high-end divorce attorneys were panting about a payout to Sue Ann Hamm that could go as high as $6 billion or even $8 billion. Smarter money had it around $3 billion. The question is, said one perhaps envious high-end divorce lawyer from neighboring Texas, will Mrs. Hamm come out of this trial filthy rich or filthy, filthy, filthy rich? Harold Hamm had been worth a little more than $50 million when the couple married in 1988. By the time Sue Ann filed for divorce in May 2012, the couple's billions of dollars in assets were almost all in Continental Resources stock. That stock had appreciated in value 894% in just 7 years. The financial outcome of the divorce, according to informed observers, would turn on active appreciation of property versus passive appreciation of property. Active appreciation includes all of the asset appreciation that's due to the wit and genius and leadership skills and business judgment of one or both spouses. Mrs. Hamm was entitled to some of that. Passive appreciation is all of the asset appreciation that had accrued by the Wheel of Fortune method, beyond one's control, like other people's inventiveness or the rise in real estate values or the fluctuating price of oil. Mrs. Hamm had much less, if any, claim on the wealth that had accrued in this way. And so
Harold was doing his ham-handed darndest to play down any of his own role in building up the share value of Continental Resources. Mrs. Ham was an attorney who had been an executive at Continental for years. She'd been active in the business, and she knew all about the operations and the value of the company. Her lawyers were said to be ready to present plenty of active appreciation expert testimony, attesting to her husband's business acumen and his nose for oil. I mean, just read the glossy magazines. Mrs. Ham's main expert witness had this telling fact to proffer. Energy companies had turned, on average, about a 700% return investment in the last 25 years. Harold Ham's Continental Resources had returned 44,000%. Gotta be genius, right? Mrs. Ham's attorneys also promised to present as evidence that now-erased golden oldie from previous Continental proxy filings. Mr. Ham has successfully grown the company through his leadership skills and his business judgment. Harold's attorneys would beg to differ. Even though the press was shut out of the courtroom, the quotable Texas divorce attorney was happy to explain to reporters the gist of Ham's legal team's argument. Harold didn't invent fracking or the new horizontal drilling technology or cause the price of oil to increase because of turmoil in the Middle East. These are all factors that Ham's lawyers and experts are going to point to as being mostly responsible for the increase in the company's value. In early November 2014, after more than 9 weeks of trial testimony, all but 3 days of it closed to the public, the judge announced his decision. Sue Ann was not well pleased. She would definitely be appealing the judgment, her attorneys insisted. Harold, on the other hand, emerged from court a happy man. His divorce bill had come in at just under $1 billion. Just one. The judge ordered Harold to hand over to Sue Ann about $23 million in real property, including their 6,400-acre ranch in California, and he was ordered to write Sue Ann a check for $322 million by the end of 2014, and then to write her one $7 million check minimum every month until the remaining $650 million was paid up. Oh, thank God, is that all? But then, the very week that judgment was handed down, the ground under Harold Ham's feet started getting seismically active, metaphorically speaking. The price of West Texas crude had been dropping from $105 a barrel in July down to near $75 by mid-November. Harold was misplaying the drop in a very public way. He let it be known that he had sold all his hedges. He was all in on the future of oil. "We feel like we're at the bottom rung here on prices," he explained on a call to analysts in early November, "and we'll see them recover pretty drastically, pretty quick." What happened next went a long way toward proving the argument his own divorce attorneys made in court. Harold Ham was wrong on both counts. The price of crude continued its drop pretty drastically, pretty quick, falling from $75 in mid-November to $66 at the beginning of December, and then to $50 a barrel by January 5th, 2015. Continental Resources stock had dropped to under $35 on January 5th, which was less than half its value in the summer of 2014. Half of Harold Ham's wealth had drained away in the 4 months following his billion-dollar divorce settlement. Well, on January 5th, 2015, Harold decided he wouldn't dribble out Sue Ann's settlement in $7 million increments after all. She wasn't supposed to get anything at all while her appeal was pending, but he decided he would take one big swing at ending this thing once and for all. That day, January 5th, he issued her a personal check drawn from the Harold G. Ham Trust for the entire amount of the divorce settlement. It took two lines to hold the handwritten number, $974,790,317.77. The offer was not received in the spirit Ham had hoped. Sue Ann did cash the check, but issued a public statement. "Accepting the payment of less than 10% of our estate does not negate the principles at stake. My principles have not changed. I still believe the trial court's award was not fair and equitable. I will not dismiss my appeal and do not feel that my right to appeal should be denied because I have accepted in the interim a small portion of the estate that we built over more than two decades. Less than a month later, the New York Times pulled back the curtain just enough for a very unbecoming glimpse of what had really transpired in that Oklahoma County divorce court. When an Oklahoma divorce makes the national section of the New York Times, it's never going to be good. Some in the courtroom started calling Harold Hams the Jed Clampett defense, after the lead character in the Beverly Hillbillies TV series, who got rich after tapping a gusher in his swampland, wrote Robert Frank, who failed to note that Clampett had tapped that gusher with a rifle shot quite by accident. Then one day he was shooting at some food, and up from the ground came the bubbling crude. You remember. Quoting again from the Times, during his testimony, the typically commanding Mr. Ham, who had been the face of the company for decades, said he couldn't recall certain decisions, didn't know much about the engineering aspects of oil drilling, and didn't attend critical meetings. Harold's lawyers told the court that by their calculation, only 5 to 10% of Harold's wealth came from his own effort, skill, management, or investment. The hits on Harold Hamm kept coming. On March 3, 2015, EnergyWire's Mike Sorrigan began reporting out the fruits of a recent open records request. He had in hand, among other things, emails from the University of Oklahoma and the Oklahoma Geological Survey that revealed the meetings Hamm had demanded with the state scientists and the university faculty overseeing their work. Sorrigan noted Hamm's gifts to the university and the director's fees Continental Resources paid to the university's president, David Boren. He made a pretty compelling case that Hamm had been strong-arming the OGS leadership and scientists. Boren declined comment when the first of the stories broke. Hamm demurred, too, through his previously courageous spokeswoman. It is what it is, said Continental VP Kristen Thomas, as Sorrigan continued adding to the sordid story. OGS is a public agency paid for by taxpayers. They have hundreds of meetings. It's not a conspiracy. The story got some more national pickup that spring, but Hamm remained fairly mum. He said nothing about it at Forbes magazine's Reinventing America Summit, where Forbes humbly billed him as the face of the American dream. All the press surrounding the OGS did draw out the head of New Dominion, who had been the chief architect and proponent of the dewatering process that occasioned so many injection wells in central and north central Oklahoma. EnergyWire's Sorrigan reported on correspondence that made the very strong case that the founder and president of New Dominion, David Chernicki, had been alerted to the possibility of injection well-induced earthquakes way back in 2007, after a magnitude 3.0 tumbler hit near Tinker Air Force Base. The quake was very near where the company was injecting 100,000 barrels of wastewater a day, back into two injection wells, which were named Deep Throat and Sweetheart. Speaking for myself, that earthquake hitting right next to the twinned disposal wells, an OGS staffer named Dan Boyd later wrote, nailed the correlation. Boyd got a meeting with Chernicki, who was pleasant enough and agreed to give over some logs and pay for seismic monitoring at the site to study the correlation. But Boyd never forgot Chernicki's nonchalance. He came in a golf shirt and shorts, a John Boehner tan, and he brought three or four phones, Boyd said. He would stop the meeting to get on the phone. He must have done that 15 times. The heads up from Boyd and the OGS didn't clip New Dominion's wings, not considering that a New Dominion injection well was among the most likely triggers of the magnitude 5.7 monster earthquake in Prague in 2011, a fact that was getting plenty of play by the spring of 2015, when Chernicki came out swinging in an interview with Bloomberg. He sang the praises of dewatering, which had revived tired old abandoned oil fields. I try to pick the ugly girl at the dance, Chernicki told the Bloomberg reporter. A charmer was Chernicki. He was even more colorful talking about the absurdity of induced seismicity. The meager amount of science put forward is so flawed, it can't even be considered science, Chernicki said. It's emotion. He trotted out Gene Antonides, and his horseshit theories about the rapid pressure changes in underground aquifers caused by the drought monsoon cycles. He leaned on the equally horseshit theory about the tectonic shifts happening all over the globe. Look at Japan and Haiti. When confronted with the notion that he was just kicking up dust so he wouldn't have to take any of the blame for the earthquakes, Czernicki bristled. He insists nature's on his side, the Bloomberg profile concluded. If humans can cause an earthquake, Czernicki said, then they can probably fart and shift the orbit of the planet, too. So, maybe not the most eloquent defender of the industry. In the middle of all the press hoo-ha, Austin Holland stuck to his knitting. He had plenty to keep him busy. He was doing his research, working with the governor's new coordinating committee to help the Oklahoma Corporation Commission define safer volume limits on injection wells and better ways to monitor those wells. He was racing to complete a preliminary single map of faults in Oklahoma so both the drillers and the commission could try to make rational siting decisions. This was a killer job, which required Holland and his team to parse, as he remembered it, 60 different versions of faults in some areas and work out some average aggregate for that area and try to decide, okay, this is from 3D seismic. It's better than this fault that was mapped from well tops. So it was a lot of work to take all these different data sets and go through them acre by acre on my computer and clean that up such that it was appropriate for publication. Holland was proud of that early map, just as he was proud that the Oklahoma Corporation Commission's new traffic light system he had helped develop was starting to come online. The commission lacked the authority to institute any full-on moratorium on oil and gas activity, but it could now at least temporarily shut down operations within a specified distance of where any new seismicity occurred. That was actual progress. Holland had become, withal, an incredible asset to the state of Oklahoma, not just for his scientific contributions, but as an increasingly able and soothing explainer for any audience. He could elucidate the process of dewatering and how injecting billions of barrels of ancient, brackish, salty, norm-carrying, carcinogenic wastewater back into the ground was the safest way to dispose of it. This is not water that we want pumped out onto the surface of the earth, he would say. He could describe how the Arbuckle Formation, well below the water table, had fantastic permeability and could accept huge volumes of wastewater, but that there were limits, and wastewater could travel and have effects on faults quite far away from the well and over long periods of time. He could explain why operators needed to leave barriers between the Arbuckle and the strata directly below it, the basement. The basement was where most of the seismic activity actually happened. Any injection well driller who punctured through to the basement had made a mistake. We know that if you were actually injecting in the basement, he could explain to oil and gas pros, you're much more likely to trigger seismicity. After more than 5 years in Oklahoma, Holland had learned how to talk to the oil and gas crowd. He knew just how to urge them, gently, to be careful about the messes they left behind after the oil and gas was captured, because being careful was good business. Really, one of the things that can be incredibly useful is the same level of reservoir engineering and reservoir modeling that goes into your production environment may be just as warranted as for disposal wells, he told one group. And that's an incredible rethinking. But there are now disposal wells that have been shut down within Oklahoma, so that's a lost investment. So by spending some investment up front, you may help protect the investment of a disposal well and being able to use it within your production environment for the future. In the end, his diplomacy, his thoroughgoing patience, and his diligence had won the day. He should have picked up the New York Times on April 22, 2015, and read these words as a triumph. Abandoning years of official skepticism, Oklahoma's government on Tuesday embraced a scientific consensus that earthquakes rocking the state are largely caused by the underground disposal of billions of barrels of wastewater from oil and gas wells. In a news release issued Tuesday, Governor Mary Fallon called the Geological Survey's endorsement of that relationship significant and said the state was dealing with the problem. The governor had come a long way from, yeah, that was crazy, and parroting Devon Energy talking points. But by then, Austin Holland was going, going, gone. The spokeswoman for Oklahoma University, Catherine Bishop, handed reporters a copy of the letter Holland had written to his colleagues he was leaving behind. The main reason for the move is to change my family dynamics, Holland wrote. I have averaged 80 hours each week for the 5.5 years I have been here. I want to change my work-life balance, and this opportunity is a good way to do that. The state's great explainer was leaving for a job with the U.S. Geological Survey in New Mexico, and he offered no further explanation at the time. He kept to himself the real reason he left, which was a dressing down by Dean Grillot for publishing a peer-reviewed paper in Science titled Coping with Earthquakes Induced by Fluid Injection. Grillot has said he doesn't recall having reprimanded Austin Holland that day or ever having put pressure on Dr. Holland to alter his research or conclusions. But Holland sure recalls getting the drift that his boss was not at all happy that the paper in Science made policy statements and offered policy recommendations. The dean seemed to be fixated on one particular passage, Holland later said. For purposes of transparency and avoiding public distrust, it is important to put the results of these seismic network operations into the public domain in near real time. Even if a network is owned and operated by industry, regulators must ensure that seismic data are not withheld from the public. Similarly, making injection data, such as daily injection rates, wellhead pressures, depth of injection interval, and properties of the target information, making that publicly accessible can be invaluable for attaining a better understanding of fluid-induced earthquakes. Open sharing of data can benefit all stakeholders, including industry, by enabling the research needed to develop more effective techniques for reducing the seismic hazard. Wait. Did he say open sharing of data? That was the offending statement that seems to have occasioned this meeting with the dean at the university, a meeting Holland later described as a gut check moment. He knew right then he was done. I was just disappointed and devastated, he said. I had taken the job at the Oklahoma Geological Survey because it was a perfect mix of what I wanted to do. Seismology is a field where you're studying something that has a direct impact on people's lives. I'd spent my time, you know, working toward something, and I thought I was in my dream job. And then I couldn't be a scientist and do what scientists do, and that's publish with colleagues. That's the point at which I realized that for my scientific credibility, I had to leave the position I was in. By the time Austin Holland packed up his U-Haul and headed west for New Mexico, Harold Hamm was in serious damage control mode. He had even given an exclusive interview to Energy Wire's Mike Sorrigan, the reporter who had ferreted out the news of Hamm telling Oklahoma University to shut up Austin Holland. Hamm thought Sorrigan's earlier coverage kind of smacked of undue pressure and inappropriate behavior, and that's not what we're all about here at Continental. He wanted to, you know, set the record straight. Hamm says he wasn't trying to bully Oklahoma's state seismologist, Sorrigan wrote in the first paragraph of his account of the interview. We were in there because we are involved in fracture stimulation. We're the most active horizontal driller in Oklahoma, Hamm said, not exactly taking the question of bullying by the horns. He went on to explain what an approachable guy he was and how he always tries to do the right thing. I don't try to push anybody around. A few days later, Bloomberg would belie that statement by printing the Grillot email about his July 2014 meeting with Hamm. Mr. Hamm is very upset at some of the earthquake reporting to the point that he would like to see select OGS staff dismissed. Hamm explained in the interview with Sorrigan that he included the university president, David Boren, who also sat on Continental's board of directors, in that Austin Holland meeting because he was a peer, unlike Holland, and an all-around sensitive soul. One thing about David Boren, he's always been very, very concerned about other people's well-being, Hamm told Sorrigan. He doesn't want to see anybody trampled on, and he's not going to do that. David Boren, for his part, told Energy Wire that Hamm asked for the meeting because he wanted to hear any information which might be helpful to producers in adopting best practices that would help any possible connection between drilling and seismic events. Uh-huh. Sure he did. But Ham was still insisting Austin Holland's conclusion about induced seismicity was flat wrong. And by Ham's judgment, Holland was just a pawn in a much bigger fight. The war on fossil fuels, Ham explained to Sorrigan, was so much bigger than anybody understood and so much more dangerous. Ham believes that the discussion of earthquakes and fracking plays into the hands of an active campaign to demonize the United States' oil and gas renaissance, Sorrigan wrote. That renaissance has been made possible by hydraulic fracturing and horizontal drilling. He sees the hand of petroleum-dependent Russia in the efforts to disparage it. It all ties back, said Ham. Which was nuts, of course. But it wasn't that much more nuts than the truth. Chapter 26. It All Ties Back. The appearance of the man standing guard outside the Holiday Inn conference room door, in full, snappy Cossack regalia, a fur hat perched nimbly atop his skull, and a leather whip attached to his belt, that was a pretty strong indication of strange happenings inside. For anyone who stepped through that door on March 22, 2015, and beheld the delegates of the first International Russian Conservative Forum, there was little doubt that this conclave was full-on Star Wars bar scene. There was the odd lot of conferees in a mix of epaulette-fringed quasi-military uniforms and bargain rack mufti, the buzz of new alliances being forged in a stew of suspected intergalactic jealousies, long-ago but unforgotten spites, and very current